This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Friday, May 8, 2009. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. New unemployment figures are out today. We'll hear why it isn't all bad news. Some members of Congress are furious at President Obama's proposed spending reductions. And we'll go to the West Bank, where nonviolent protesters say they were attacked by Israeli troops. Stay tuned for those stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Pakistan military launched a full-scale attack on Taliban forces in the Swat region today. The government says over 100 militants have been killed so far, in addition to several of the country's soldiers. The UN's refugee agency says the roads out of the war zone are packed as 300,000 civilians continue to flee. UNICEF spokeswoman Miranda Ellis spoke to UN Radio.
The majority of those worst affected are children who have witnessed violence, experienced displacement, and faced interruptions to education and health services. The displaced people have minimal resources and require safe water, clothing, food, shelter, and health care.
Nearly 100,000 refugees are staying at camps maintained by international aid organizations. The Italian government has sent 227 immigrants back to Libya without processing or even allowing them to touch Italian soil, marking a shift in policy that has human rights groups concerned. FSRN's Diletta Varlese reports.
Earlier this week, officials found the immigrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea and heading to Sicily. The immigrants remained on the water while Italy and Libya argued over who should take them. Finally, Italian Interior Minister Roberto Maroni convinced Libya to take the group back in accordance with an agreement signed by the two countries in February. This is the first time the Italian government has rejected immigrants in this manner. The move violates the UN Refugee Commission's regulations for handling asylum seekers. Often those crossing from northern Africa are people escaping war and looking for humanitarian protection. In past years, immigration centers in Sicily received and screened the new arrivals. The UN Refugee Commission also criticized Italy's decision because Libya has not signed the Geneva Convention on Human Rights and has no proper structure to support asylum seekers. Diletta Varlese, FSRN, Brescia, Italy.
Arrests of Colombian soldiers alleged to have killed civilians and passed them off as criminals continued this week. The so-called false positive scandal broke out last September when journalists discovered the army had executed 11 young men in the city of Ocaña and registered them as members of paramilitary groups. From Bogota, Manuel Rueda has the latest.
The most recent soldiers arrested allegedly killed young men and passed them off as members of drug trafficking gangs in order to gain promotion and vacation time. The Colombian army has fought an unofficial war against guerrilla groups and drug traffickers for over 3 decades. And President Uribe's government demands that soldiers show concrete results before they are allowed promotions and benefits. Analysts say Uribe's policies have helped to improve security in many parts of the country, but his critics say it's come at the expense of human rights. Former President Andrés Pastrana recently spoke out against the latest army scandal.
We call this a false positive here, but anywhere else in the world this would be called a state crime.
Uribe initially purged the army of 24 officers, vying to bring these practices to a close. Over the past 6 months, prosecutors have launched investigations of some 900 members of the Colombian military. These cases allegedly occurred between 2005 and early 2008. But in April, the government admitted that another false positive killing happened as recently as December 2008. Manuel Rueda, FSRN, Bogota.
A vermiculite mining company accused of knowingly exposing the residents of Libby, Montana to asbestos is off the hook. Today, a federal judge acquitted W.R. Grace & Company and its executives. Attorneys for the town's residents argued that 225 people have died from asbestos exposure. One resident, who lost both her parents to lung disease, told the AP W.R. Grace has gotten away with murder. A wildfire near Santa Barbara, California, is continuing to grow stronger, threatening the lives of emergency personnel in thousands of homes. Today, firefighters struggled to fight the 5-mile line of flame, but the fire is only 10% contained. 20,000 residents have left the area. A new study estimates that 3.5 million children under the age of 5 may face hunger in the U.S. Malcolm Glover in Little Rock, Arkansas, has the details.
The study by the nonprofit advocacy group Feeding America relies on data from the U.S. Census Bureau and the Agriculture Department. According to the study's findings, in 11 states, more than 20% of children under 5 are at risk of going hungry. Louisiana has the highest rate, followed by North Carolina and a host of other states, including Ohio, Texas, New Mexico, and Arkansas. Laura Ray is the president of the Arkansas Rice Depot.
We provide food to public schools all across Arkansas, and we are getting calls almost daily of new schools who are saying, we're noticing more and more children who are coming to school hungry because they've had little or nothing to eat.
Ray says when the school year ends and children are left without the safety net of the Food for Kids program, combating hunger will get even harder. The number of hungry kids in the U.S. could currently be even higher because data from the recession still isn't available. Malcolm Glover, FSRN, Little Rock.
And finally today, relatives of a slain Iraqi girl called on a Kentucky court to sentence her murderer to death. Yesterday, the court convicted U.S. Army Private Stephen Green of raping and murdering the girl in 2006 while he was stationed in the country. A sentencing is expected on Monday. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns.
Let the showdown begin. Some Congress members are fuming over President Obama's proposed spending cuts in the budget. Nevertheless, those reductions are tiny compared to significant increases in other areas. FSRN's Tanya Snyder brings us the numbers and what they say about the administration's priorities.
The budget is a 1,500-page beast of a document that lays out the president's priorities. It's not just numbers. The budget is where policy gets set and programs get boosted or slashed. The 2010 budget spends $3.4 trillion and would lead to a deficit of more than $1 trillion for next year. Advocates for every cause look to the budget to see where the administration stands on their issue. Immigrant rights advocates like Rosella Martinez of the National Immigration Forum see Obama's immigration priorities take shape in his budget.
It is primarily focused on enforcement, although there are some interesting new things like immigrant integration programs, increased attention to the administrative judicial system, the immigration court system. But I think that we see these as, you know, pieces that reaffirm kind of the groundwork that the president has been laying.
Obama's proposal increases the Homeland Security Department's budget by 6%, increasing spending on border security both to control immigration and to stem the flow of U.S. guns and money down to the Mexican drug cartels. But the budget is as telling in what it cuts as what it funds. James Horney of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says Obama has made some bold moves.
The president has proposed a number of loophole closures in the tax system, cuts in some programs that tend to benefit higher income people.
Some of those programs include farm subsidies, but not to the mom-and-pop farmers.
I think a lot of people in the country are very sympathetic to trying to provide some assistance to small family farms. But in fact, a lot of the money that we spend goes to very wealthy farm operations.
But it's the cuts to defense programs that have members of Congress up in arms. The defense budget is 1% bigger than last year. But that includes lots of big changes, like big increases in counterterrorism funding for Pakistan. And for the first time, funding for the war in Afghanistan overtakes money for the war in Iraq. But Defense Secretary Robert Gates did cut some big-ticket items. Winslow Wheeler works on military reform at the Center for Defense Information.
We need to weed out the bad, high-cost, ultra-complex weapon systems. Gates weeded out a few of those. Congress loves those programs because they bring jobs and spending to their states and districts. But we are much better off without those high-cost complexities.
Another big cut in the president's budget was to abstinence-only sex education programs. He's replacing them with comprehensive teen pregnancy prevention and spending more on those than the previous administration spent on the Just Say No initiatives. The Food and Drug Administration was one of the big winners in the budget. The beleaguered agency has been criticized for not being able to keep up with safety threats, but they're getting almost a 20% boost in their funding, the biggest funding increase the agency has ever seen. It will pay for more than 1,000 new employees. Spending for veterans benefits grew with this budget, too. Brandon Freeman is a veteran of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and vice chair of VoteVets.org, which advocates on behalf of veterans.
They're going to do a lot from mental health in terms of veterans who have combat post-traumatic stress disorder. There is the post-9/11 GI Bill, which we're very pleased to see go into effect this year.
And the Environmental Protection Agency, still recovering from the Bush years, hit the jackpot with a 35% jump in funding. EPA officials say they're thrilled about what they call extraordinary support and a revitalized mission. Members of Congress will still have their shot at the budget. They'll need to vote on each aspect of the budget in appropriations bills throughout the year. Tanya Snyder, FSRN, in Washington.
Unemployment figures for April were released today, and the numbers are better than what some economists anticipated. The market shed 539,000 jobs in April, bringing the unemployment rate to 8.9%, and that's up from 8.5% the previous month. Despite that percentage rising, and despite the fact that the unemployment rate is the highest it's been since 1983, keep in mind that nearly 700,000 jobs were lost in March. To be exact, the number of people who lost their jobs in March was originally estimated at 663,000, but it was corrected to 699,000, making the estimated 539,000 jobs lost in April sound a little better. We're joined on the line by Chris Tilley. He's an economist and the director of UCLA's Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here.
When you were on a month ago, the number of jobs lost in March was pegged at 663,000. The Labor Department has now corrected that to 669,000. How is it then that these numbers are calculated, and how accurate is that measurement?
Well, it's based on reporting from employers. And so some employers drag their feet in reporting to the government. The adjustments come from basically late reporting.
And April's numbers are better than March. It's estimated that 539,000 jobs were lost, which is a lot less than that 669,000 in March. Yet the percentage is higher at 8.9. Why is that?
Well, if you look closely at what's happening, the unemployment rate has continued to march up as it has, about 0.4, 4-tenths of a percent a month. But if you look at the broader measure that includes not just the unemployed but also the involuntary part-time, the people who are working part-time would like to be full-time, and the people who are not currently looking for work but would like a job, those numbers do not look as bad. So it does seem like there's some moderation happening. Things are getting worse, but they're not getting worse as quickly as they have been. It is important to point out that the 539,000 job loss figure includes an offset that's 66,000 temporary census employees. That's a blip that is not really long-term employment.
And what you just referred to is something we talked about last month, which is called the U6, which is this broader unemployment rate that measures, as you said, the number of people who have given up looking for work, those who are working part-time because they can't find full-time work, and those who have left the workforce entirely, along with the so-called total unemployed. This month, it's at 15.8. Last month, it was at 15.6. Is this a silver lining, since it's not a huge hike from one month to the other?
It is something of a silver lining. And in some ways, what's happening is that people who before might have been working part-time when they were looking for full-time are now not working at all. People who might have not been looking because they were giving up have now felt like they have to look. But when you add those people into the regular pool of officially unemployed, the overall increase is smaller. The numbers are bigger. There are more people stuck in that situation, but the increase is smaller than it's been in previous months. And that is a silver lining, that we're not going to hell quite as quickly as we have been the last few months.
And finally, it seems like the closer we get to 10% unemployment, the more the media seems to suggest that we're approaching numbers that are comparable to the Great Depression. Is there any truth to that?
The numbers are not comparable to the Great Depression yet. They are certainly comparable to the Great Recession that some people called a depression in the early 1980s, where we did go above 10%. I think it's fair to to call unemployment numbers of 10% or above depression level. And certainly when you take into account the fact that particular groups, particularly teens and black workers, get hit much harder, there are some people who are already in a depression, and there's a lot of people for whom it really feels like a depression. So I don't think it's out of line to use the word depression when you get to 10% and above. But no, I mean, during the Great Depression, you had in the 20s up to around 30% unemployed, and that's a whole other level of economic misery.
Chris, thanks for joining us again.
All right, take care.
Chris Tilley is an economist and the director of UCLA's Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. You're listening to FSRN. I'm Maura Bogado. One measurement often overlooked in this financial crisis is the money that is sent or not sent home from Latin American migrants working or not working in the U.S. A new study indicates that financial hardships will result in migrant workers sending $5 billion less than last year to support their families south of the border. FSRN's Sam Greenspan has more.
Immigrants in the U.S. send more than $50 billion a year in remittances to family members in their home countries. In some places, this constitutes a high percentage of a country's gross domestic product. Natasha Bajuk is with the Inter-American Development Bank, which lends to developing countries.
These are flows that are motivated by a family obligation. Migrants do what they can to cover the need of the family that they left, probably after a very difficult decision to uproot themselves and look for an economic well-being abroad to generate savings and send money home.
The Inter-American Dialogue, a D.C.-based think tank, released a study looking at the impact of fewer remittances. This could have repercussions in places like Haiti, where, according to the report, the lowest tier of the U.S. labor pool makes up one-third of that country's GDP. The report estimates total remittances will drop $5 billion this year, down to $64 billion. This means some 1 million households won't receive money in 2009, and another 4 million will receive 10% less. But Manuel Orozco, the author of the report, says the remittance money shouldn't just be used for families to buy consumer goods, but to use as seed money for small businesses.
And also to increase and motivate migrants to invest back in their home countries, especially that in some ways and in some countries, the attractiveness to invest back home might be higher today because their economies are not as damaged as in the United States.
The Latino immigrant population has been hit particularly hard by the economic downturn. Immigrant employment is at 9.7%, the highest level since data began to be collected 15 years ago, and a full percentage point higher than rates for native-born U.S. citizens. Sam Greenspan, FSRN, Washington.
Tomorrow marks the 75th anniversary of a pivotal strike that changed the trajectory of the labor movement in the United States. In 1934, ports along the West Coast came to a standstill as dock workers walked off the job demanding safer working conditions and an end to discriminatory hiring practices. As Africa Jones reports, the struggles of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union opened up new possibilities for all of the nation's unions.
Beginning in May of 1934, dock workers from Seattle to Los Angeles directly confronted police to challenge the hiring practices of shipping companies. Harvey Schwartz is coordinator of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union Oral Collection and author of an upcoming book on the ILWU. He says a 1930s dock worker faced tough challenges.
But you had to pay sometimes a kickback for your job. In Los Angeles, you had to bring a jug of wine or a turkey or whatever to the boss to get a job. And one longshoreman told me this, and I have no reason to doubt it, that if you brought your wife or girlfriend to the waterfront to service the hiring person, you might get a job.
Led by longshoreman Harry Bridges and the International Longshoremen Association, the strike lasted 83 days and was the first industry-wide strike in the shipping industry. After suffering a couple of decades of setbacks, the ILA and unions in the U.S. were reinvigorated from the 1933 passage of the National Industrial Recovery Act, which in part permitted workers to organize and bargain with employers. But even with federal protection, Dr. Cal Livy, a historian at San Francisco State University, says the actions of the Longshoremen Association were bold.
By 1934, although there had been some stabilization, unemployment still ran very high. And the risks that these workers were taking were incredible, not just to their livelihoods, but to their lives.
President Franklin Roosevelt attempted to arbitrate the crisis, but neither side would agree on terms. Meanwhile, police in San Francisco, one of the nation's premier maritime cities at the time, began escalating confrontations with strikers.
The police in San Francisco, the mayor, Angelo Rossi, and the warehouse owners really worked together to try and intimidate the strikers and conspire to try and break the strike. And this is what ultimately turns into Bloody Thursday.
A police blast killed two people and injured dozens of others on July 5th, a day still recognized as a holiday by the union. And the deaths compelled workers in the city to call a general strike, effectively shutting San Francisco down. The mayor of the city called a state of emergency, and Hugh Johnson, a Roosevelt appointee, spoke out against the strikers.
You are living out here under the stress of a general strike. The right of dissatisfied men to strike against a recalcitrant employer is inviolate. But the general strike is quite another matter. That is a threat to the community. That is a menace to government. That is civil war.
Cal Livy says that given the economic and political climate of the times, the port closure and general strike were a nightmare scenario for those in power.
This is something the Roosevelt administration feared, that if a general strike was called in such a vital port in San Francisco, and if it spread, it would cripple the United States. There were fears at this time in American history that the United States was very close to teetering towards a revolution.
After the general strike, both the union and shipping companies finally agreed to federal arbitration, and a deal was struck by October. Warehouse workers in the 30s joined the association, which eventually was split and became the International Longshore Warehouse Union. Its members have also been well known for supporting progressive causes around the world. Harvey Schwartz says that the ILW's struggles have had a long-lasting impact and serve as an example of what people can accomplish if they work together.
All kinds of workers and all kinds of industries decided, hey, if the longshoremen can do it, we can do it too. I mean, in one sense, you can say it's a precedent for 1935 for the rise of the CIO and that huge organizing drive in steel, auto, rubber, and other major industries. The Longshore Union also helped other unions get organized, retail clerks, auto workers. And because of its stance on race, its stance on helping others organize, its general progressive stance in international relations, it got this great reputation, which it still has.
Many events to commemorate the anniversary of the strike are scheduled in the upcoming weeks. Africa Jones, FSRN.
Scores of Palestinians, Israelis, and international activists participated in nonviolent actions in the West Bank, calling for an end to the occupation. As FSRN's Hassan Banoura reports, some demonstrators say they were attacked by Israeli defense forces.
Eight were injured when Israeli forces attacked the weekly nonviolent protest of Bil'in, a small Palestinian village near central West Bank that has been protesting the Israeli wall being built on farmers' land for the past 4 years. Abdullah Abu Rahma from the village committee against the wall and settlements was among those injured today.
The title of Bil'in protest today was Stop the Occupation Flu. There is a concern all over the world about the swine flu. We say people have the right to take care of their health. But our message is that we have been facing another disease for the last 61 years, the Israeli occupation.
At another demonstration today near Bil'in, Israeli soldiers attacked Palestinian and international peace activists holding the weekly nonviolent protest against the wall in Na'lin village. Five protesters were injured and dozens were treated for the effect of gas inhalation. Earlier today, in the southern West Bank city of Hebron, Israeli police detained 11 nonviolent protesters and injured several others during a peaceful action against Israeli settlements. Eight Israelis, two internationals, and one Palestinian were arrested by Israeli troops and police. Badi'a Dweik is with Youth Gathering Against Settlements in Hebron, the group that organized today's event.
The settlers erected a new outpost on our land a month ago. Today our action was to build a room for our youth near their post. The settlers attacked local and foreign protesters and even attacked Israeli supporters. Our goal is to say this is Palestinian land.
Also in southern West Bank, four farmers were lightly wounded when Israeli soldiers used batons to stop people from reaching their agricultural land during a protest organized by farmers at Al-Ma'sara village near Bethlehem. Ghassan Bannoura, Afasaran, Bethlehem.
And now a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Before nation, as the temperature of war increases in Iraq and the U.S. increases troops in Afghanistan, an unanswered question looms. Not what is a nation, so much as why is this a nation and when? When we speak of Iraq, Afghanistan, or even Pakistan as nation states, we're really speaking of political elites in their capitals and of relatively new political identities that are not truly agreed upon, even in those states. Many of these nations had their borders drawn not by themselves, but by diplomats in Europe, more for their interest than for the inhabitants thereof. Let me give just one example. Remember the former Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf? In the year he was born, there was no Pakistan. He was born a citizen of Northwest India. In many of these countries, there are millions of people who see themselves first and foremost as members of ancient tribes to whom loyalty lies. They are Pashtun, Punjabi, or Tajik. In Ayan Hirsi Ali's autobiographical work, Infidel, she recounts the childhood memory of her and her sister standing in their backyard in Somalia, reciting the lineage of their clan. Standing over them was grandmother, a switch in hand. And woe to the child who would forget or overlook an ancestor. Her grandmother didn't demand that she recount the rulers of Somalia. What was important was tribe, clan, and subclan history and lineage. For millions of people in Africa and South Asia, one's clan is crucial. Nation is ephemeral. For before nation, there was clan. When one is in distress, there is clan. When one is endangered, there is clan. Nation is a collective of strangers. Nation is the faraway capital. Nation is the oppressive force that imposes taxation or unwanted military presence. As the U.S. under Obama plans to downsize in Iraq and beef up in Afghanistan, it faces a force that Americans have not had to consider for several centuries, the power of tribes. This is the true social and political power that lies beneath the ossified and often corrupt national governments in which the U.S. has invested billions. There is the formal nation state with all of the structure that Americans like, but unseen is the true movers and shakers of society, identity formers, tribes. This may be the rock upon which all U.S. efforts, all its billions, all of its military might shatters. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. A very happy Mother's Day. Enjoy your weekend. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.